Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here with you as always. Kevin, what's up, my friend?
Well, what's up? You always say what's up with me, but I should say what's up with you. And how is the Queen's, as he's got to be getting close to his first birthday, right?
He's getting close, man. Baby the Queen's is like a little Roman emperor that I have to follow around and try to please, or otherwise he ruins my workday. And I'm not joking about that. If you're a parent, you understand exactly what I'm saying. Nonetheless, he's healthy. I'm watching him in his crib right now. He's putting blocks into a little square wooden box, and he's content. And there's nothing like being a dad. It's worth it every moment. So
that's good. So he's my friend, J.D. Swanson. Dr. Swanson used to say, the best part of a baby is when it gets out of the worm phase.
Yeah. Yes, they are easier to handle in the worm phase, but it's very exciting to watch a person that you literally made grow up and start to make their way through the world and interact with things around them. And it's, I don't know, it's just incredible. So have kids is what I'm saying, if you can, unless you suck. If you suck, don't have kids.
Well, working on it. I mean, we still are thinking maybe it'll happen one of these days.
You'd be a great dad, Kevin. I could see your son or daughter out there on the farm with you.
Yeah. I got the jokes down already.
Oh, man. Yeah, you'll be embarrassing them by the time they're 4 or 5 years old.
I could do like pull my finger all day. It'd make me laugh. No, well, but I wanted to touch on, you know, the name De Queens and why we said your baby's name is De Queens. Because many people are listening who maybe didn't catch the original thing on that. And
you got to tell the story.
Well, back when you had the baby, we had a guest who sat in for you, and it was Allie, one of my former students, who's awesome. And Allie sat in, and we talked about, you know, your baby and why she was there. And we thought, well, maybe we could come up with a name for your baby since you'd be looking for one, and your last name is English. And so what would be a good name? And you know, obviously things like Broken and all that aren't the best kids' names. These days, maybe, I don't know, but we thought like we'd go with De Queens, like the D hyphen Queens. So De Queens English, which sounded a lot like an NFL linebacker, but that.
It's a great name. It's a great name. Yeah, and if he does grow up to be an NFL player, then I'm going to buy a giant mansion somewhere. And I'll tell this story until my dying breath, because it's a great one. There's one other thing I wanted to share today. This is in reference to nothing we were talking about. So my wife yesterday sends me an email because she's at school and she can't talk on the phone because she's a teacher. So she sends me this email and she thinks it's a Wikipedia page about me. And she says, you should reach out to them and see if you can get this corrected, because my wife doesn't suffer fools when she sees things, especially if it's about someone she cares about. She's like, this ain't even right. Don't even try to say this. And then she realizes it's my Source Watch page.
Yeah. The worst email you ever get is the one where someone says, dude, you got to check your Wikipedia page. And then you write back and say, I don't have a Wikipedia page. And then the next email says, oh, yes, you do. But Source Watch is the worst, because it's Center for Media and Democracy, who you think is a reasonable organization. I mean, I love some of the stuff they do, but then on the other hand, they are absolutely horrible at defaming scientists and journalists. And if you don't align with what they believe or what their, you know, ideology is, look out, because they'll just libel you up and down. And they do it. And every year or two, I usually send them a nice letter and say, hey, can we talk about this? Because their website on me, nothing matches reality. And, you know, probably the same with you.
Oh no, it's mostly lies. That, you know, I'm a climate change denier. I'm a corporate shill. I defend everything, like any bad chemical. I defend it. Apparently, a lot of things they state things that are factual, but then the implication is that they're wrong. So, like I've written a bunch of articles about the herbicide Paraquat and why it doesn't cause Parkinson's, and it doesn't. I have the data on my side. I'll stand by that. But they just say he's also defended Paraquat. Like, dun, dun, dun. Oh, no. Oh, no, not Paraquat. So, well,
the one on me is kind of the same thing. They say that they have a whole paragraph that I defend Jordan Peterson. And it's like, I don't even really know who Jordan Peterson is. I mean, I know who he is, and I don't really care much about him. I mean, I've kind of always seen him as kind of a boring non-issue. And there's a whole paragraph saying that I defend him. I don't know who the guy is. All I know is that he talks like this. I'm Kermit the Frog. I'm Jordan Peterson. He just sounds like the same guy.
Oh yeah. It's just funny that, for one thing, it fools people. You know, my wife's a sharp lady and she knows about SourceWatch. Cause when I got a page, I turned it into a little bit of a celebration. Like I mentioned it on the show and I told her and I was like, look, the bad people think I'm worth writing about. So it was funny, but once she realized it, she goes, oh, it's just SourceWatch, you know? So it's like, even someone who knows to look out for it is fooled by the layout of it, because it looks like Wikipedia. And as you've said many times, they're trying to make you Google dead when people look you up. And it must have some effect because they keep doing it.
Yeah, go, because it works. And I recently got eliminated from another event opportunity because somebody said, well, maybe he's a little too controversial. And the controversy is strictly because of manufactured controversy, not actual controversy. So, you know, all the good things stand, all my record stands, but because there's a lot of bad people who say things about you, does make a difference. And you know, I hate to say that because it means that gives them a little, you know, a little fuel to say that, oh, look, it does work. But you know, it's the time we live in. So what it means is you got to just keep out producing them and take the opportunities that you lose as a gold star on your record that, you know, you're obviously over the target. So they're giving you flack, and that's the best way to think about it.
Very good. Very encouraging to anybody out there who might be getting a hard time. And
to anyone who's being libeled.
Yeah. I mean, this is small potatoes, you know. I'm not crippled emotionally, or I'm not really suffering for these dumb people. So it doesn't matter, but, yeah, stay the course, keep, you know, spitting the truth. But let's talk about some science, Kevin. So three cool stories today. First up, a once a month injection to control opioid addiction. Buprenorphine, big word, has shown enormous promise. Next up, the world wastes billions of tons of food each year. Here's how we can transform it into clean energy. And finally, tirzepatide, the drug that can help you shed 50 pounds or more, might be as effective as bariatric surgery. All very, very stunningly fascinating stories, Kevin. Let's talk about this first one, though. What are we doing here?
Well, this is a big deal because as we go around thinking about the opioid epidemic, and it still is a problem. A tremendous number of people who have opioid addiction, either, you know, because of injury where they became hooked, or because it kind of goes hand in hand with some types of homelessness or other mental illness. This idea of altered state from opioids is something that comes very natural and something that's really an epidemic problem inside the country. And with the rise of fentanyl, which is, you know, coming in over the border, it's in lookalike drugs. And, you know, we all know the story on fentanyl. So more and more, we need tools to push back against it. And, you know, we talked before about Narcan and other stuff, but buprenorphine is a really interesting opportunity to do this because it helps addicts find their way over the addiction because it's a drug that competes for the receptor that heroin and other associated drugs in the opioid class bind. So they exert their effect because of their they bind to the receptor, buprenorphine and other stuff. They are antagonists, meaning they bind the receptor in a way that's not stimulatory, that locks the receptor off. So you don't have the same effect that's happening, but you don't have the cravings and the addiction. You're able to resolve the addiction side, but without the negative psychological, or I shouldn't say psychological, psychotic, I don't even know if that's the right word. What's the word I'm fishing for here? The other effects of the drug. And so it makes this drug able to compete against what the much more negative effect of the other drug.
I got to say, as I was reading this story, I was getting increasingly frustrated because it focuses on a physician who works in Oakland, California, which is not too far from where I am. And it would be important regardless of where the story was taking place. But it's potentially people that are my neighbors, you know, people that live around me or live near me who are struggling with drug addiction, and they're being denied treatment. And this is primarily the focus of the story. Once they introduce what the drug is and how it works, they're being denied access to it, or at least delayed access to it, because of different regulations related to which pharmacies can carry it and who can prescribe it and when they can prescribe it. And, you know, sometimes there's some supply chain issues, I think. So it's really tragic, Kevin. So tell us a little bit about what's going on with these specifics.
Yeah, and that's really the punchline of the story, is that here you have a drug that can effectively combat opioid addiction that is somewhat non-accessible, and that the most effective form is an injectable form that that is sold under the brand name Sublocade. And Sublocade, been approved by the FDA for years now, but it still is under patent and still very expensive. So it's about $2,000 a month to get an injection of Sublocade. And it's a great drug, seems to work really well, seems to limit the cravings and the other issues with the addiction. And the company that makes it is very happy to sell it. So they're looking at record profits, blah, 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 you know, corporate greed, all that stuff. We can talk about that another time. The bottom line is that the high price of entry keeps people out from finding this drug. There are other types of buprenorphine that that can be found. And this is stuff that's sublingual. Those are, you know, pretty cheap. And a month's supply is not that expensive. So that one's one that insurance would rather cover. It's not as good because you got to take it every day. You know, it's much different versus the injection. And so this is really where it starts to boil down. And this is what I love about today's whole episode, is that, you know, do you want to, as a nation, invest in solving a problem, or do you want to only have this available to those who can afford it? And, you know, that's kind of a running theme throughout today's episode. But this is just something that right now, through most people who need it, can't afford it. The less expensive solution is one they're most likely to not use in the right way.
What's so bothersome about this, in my opinion, is that you're seeing the same sorts of limitations that discourage doctors from prescribing pain medication when their patients really need it. You know, like someone who gets in a car accident and crushes both their knees. That's a pretty miserable existence. And opioids are very useful for somebody in a situation like that, but doctors are afraid to prescribe it. And the effect that that has on thousands and thousands of people is that they either kill themselves, sorry to be so blunt, or they go into the streets and they buy illicit fentanyl or one of its analogs, which often kills them. So you have people denied medicine in that sense, and then they go get hooked on drugs if they survive. And then when you have people who are hooked on the drugs, they're denied treatments that could help them, which encourages them effectively to go back to these other much more harmful substances. And of course, they're not under a doctor's supervision, and they have no idea how the product was made, because it's most of it is illegally produced in South America, I believe. and it comes over the border into the United States. So this is a terribly destructive and really backwards situation. And it, and if you're one of the people who is like pro-drug war and you think we need a drug-free society, it seems to me that you should be eager to get these regulations either abolished or at least modified so that people can get the treatment that they need. Because you're not going to get that, like, if you just arrest people or, you know, what, like, however we deal with it now, this is not going to solve the problem, I don't think.
No, and that's exactly it. It's about getting people in the treatment. And if you have addiction, you know, there's so many people, there's folks I know who work in addiction medicine who have said that the addicts are the most amazing liars you've ever heard. And they'll be working either in emergency room, or one of them's a nurse who works in psychology, emergency room psychology or psychiatry. And she says, you know, they'll say, well, I took the prescription for, you know, whatever you gave me in terms of a opioid, and I went outside and it blew out of my hand and I can't find it. I need another one. You know, they'll continue to give you these excuses as to why they need to ramp up. And for you or me who, you know, doesn't have an addiction, if we take a pill or two to deal with a pain issue, an acute pain issue, it usually would work. But these are folks who, because of the tolerance that's built up from time over abuse, they're talking about having to find 12 to 100 pills a day to be able to achieve the same level of feeling and manage pain they have. So this is a real mess, and the better drugs are certainly welcome.
Yeah, 100%. And I would just encourage everyone to learn a little bit more about this issue, because you hear about it on TV, the shows that I watch, they talk about the opioid epidemic all the time. And no one really knows much about it. So I would encourage you, go to ACSH.org and just look up Dr. Josh Bloom's writing on this. He's a chemist. He knows the literature backwards and forwards. And just learn about this, because people, even so-called experts, are starting from some assumptions that are not justified by the data. And because of that, we get really bad policy, and then it takes years and years for agencies like the CDC to update their guidelines. And in the meantime, there are people suffering that we could help. We have the solution, and it's not happening. So, you know, I don't know. Don't go write your senator. I don't know if that's going to do anything, but, you know, just learn about this, because if society is informed, then we can fix things.
Yeah, very important.
All right, Kevin. So we waste all this food. Can we actually power our cars with it?
Well, this is really cool, because this is an old idea that comes back. And can you convert waste organic material into a vapor, you know, vaporize essentially the material so that you can get the most out of its combustible components? And the bottom line is that when you photosynthesize, you're busy taking carbon from the atmosphere and fixing it into much more energetic compounds that within plant metabolism are converted to even more energetic compounds. So fats, carbohydrates, proteins, all these things have energy in their bonds that we can liberate. And we do it metabolically when we eat and enzymatically take food apart. But in the process of food waste, is there a way to take the massive, massive amount of food waste that we generate and turn this into fuel? And the answer is yes. I had a professor who lit a Brazil nut on fire, and you would be amazed at the flame and the heat that comes off the damn thing, just because of the huge amount of oil and the huge amount of carbon that's been fixed inside that biological product. So this whole story talks about it. It's a story by Salvador Salas. It's the world wastes billions of tons of food each year. Here's how we can transform it into energy. And I didn't look up his whole background, but I think he's actually a researcher in this area. And there's really addressing a double problem. One, you have wasted resources that you really don't want to waste, right? Food waste, whether it's food products you could have eaten but didn't, and they maybe are past their prime, or the byproducts of food production. So things like peanut shells or, you know, banana peels, whatever, all this stuff still has energy in its bonds. And he mentions just in Canada, which I believe he's Canadian, 60% of the food, which is 35 million tons per year, ends up in landfills, and that there's no place to put it. So you're not only wasting food, you now have to dedicate a place to put the things that you don't consume. So it's a double problem. And what he's looking for is, can you go back to this idea of gasification and biomass gasification? You know, insert pull my finger joke here, right? So really what this is turning food and food waste and biological plant vegetable waste into gases that can be used as fuel. And the way that you do this is you create something called syngas. And syngas is hydrogen, methane, which are combustible, carbon dioxide, and a little bit of carbon monoxide, maybe some other stuff that's produced through this process of passing a specific solution through gas at a high temperature or through a biological waste at a high temperature, producing these gaseous components. And in essence, you're breaking this stuff down to components which still has some combustible potential and converting them into this gaseous compound. That's really the heart of this entire discussion.
Hey, this is just a personal request. Can you very briefly describe this technology in a Canadian accent? I think that would be hilarious.
This is like Great White North, eh?
Well, geez, you take the peanut shells and then you put them in
your car. You know, you got a leftover poutine and you go, you know, I ain't got room in my freezer for it, so we're going to have to do something with it. I can put on my toque and my mitts and we'll take it outside, put it in the snowbank for a while. No, I don't know. I don't have that. I just touched on like the five Canadian things I know.
Yeah. So now we know Cammy Ryan will be upset with us and Stuart Smythe.
No, Cammy, when I first came to Canada for a talk, she picked me up at the airport. I flew in from Florida and I get off the plane and I walk out into like the minus 20 snow. And she goes, "Where's your toque and your mitts?" I said, "I don't know if I have those things."
Oh, that's funny. We love you, Cammy. This is all in good fun.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in all seriousness, to get back to this for a second, this seems like a great idea, but like so many things we talk about on the show, there's all kinds of stumbling blocks, either regulatory or technical, that would prevent us from utilizing this. And here's my primary concern is at the very end of this article, the author says we need to continue taxing fossil fuels, and then we need to provide financial incentives, and we need to subsidize the development of this technology. And as a rule, if something is viable and it's going to work as well as your sales pitch says it works, then there's going to be a market for it. And so that's what concerns me. And it always cracks me up when it's somebody who works in that field or in that industry, because they're basically saying, what I do is so awesome, you should give me your money. And you know, so that bothers me a little bit. What are your thoughts?
Well, not just give me your money, you should punish my competition.
Right, exactly, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally get it. And I think that there's a lot of interest in this, and there are places where it's being done. There's the Atacogan Generating Station, which is up by Lake Superior somewhere. This generates biomass-based gas. And this is a carbon neutral process. The amount that was fixed, the amount that you create in carbon dioxide cannot exceed the amount that was fixed in the first place. So it is a carbon neutral thing. And there's other countries that are working on this, and it seems to be something that can do it. In Canada, it's 1.5% of its electricity comes from biomass generation and biomass generated heat. Or electricity. You know, it's nothing new. We used to use incineration to do this. You would just burn everything and then use the heat from the burning or the water heated from the heating to turn a turbine. And, you know, so this is nothing new. Problem with incineration is you create a lot of other gases that are not good. You create a lot of pollution. This seems to be a lot cleaner way of doing this, because you're converting food and the carbon fixed in the food into small carbon molecules that you can still, that are still flammable, but burn cleanly. So kind of not a bad idea. The place where this really can make a difference, and this is kind of a, you know, subtext of the article, is when we do food production, we're not just producing food, we're producing all kinds of waste. What about the plant that the tomatoes came from? The shells from the peanuts that the peanuts were in. I bought a bag of pistachios for my wife yesterday, and they came, the shells were already gone. And I had to take it back. I'm like, well, you're missing a lot of the pistachio, you know. No, it was, but you have these other things that are obviously waste, still biological material, still invested carbon into those structures that can be liberated as fuel. So maybe this is a step in the right direction. I don't know that this is the solution to everything, but I think it's kind of cool that at least people are thinking about it, you know, and we're moving in that direction.
I think of this the same way I tend to think of the plant and cell-based meats. In that, you know, if they're going to work, and it seems like they might, then it's a really cool idea. So pursue it and try to sell it to people, and let's get whatever benefit out of it that we can. And I think the same way about this. But in terms of like supplying the world's energy, we have a viable technology, and that's nuclear power. And it's very safe. It produces effectively unlimited amounts of energy, and we understand it very well. And it's I don't know, it's perfectly safe. I don't know how many times I can say that, but we have a nuclear scientist who writes for us at ACSH. His name is Dr. Andrew Karam, and he was with the Navy's nuclear power program for many years. Basically worked with the Navy to figure out how to power subs and you know, various I don't know, vehicles, things that can run on nuclear power. But in any case, just go over and look at his stuff. And my point in saying this is that if we're really serious about solving these energy problems, if we're really serious about addressing climate change, then let's use the stuff that we know works. And then once you do that, against that background, then you can start using these more fine-tuned or more, you know, like industry-specific solutions. So like, as you were talking about with peanut shells and, you know, plant mass and stuff, if you can recycle that stuff and turn it into energy, and maybe you can use it to fuel that enterprise, then let's do that. But we sort of operate from this place where we're going to say, okay, so we've got this massive problem. We're going to handcuff one hand behind our back, and then we're going to dump a bunch of money into these smaller things that may or may not actually work. We don't know, but it's a really cool idea. It's just a strange way to approach the problem, I think.
Well, it's also convoluted in that it doesn't deal with the problem of food waste. It says, if we're going to waste food, let's at least burn it and use it as energy. When really the better thing to do would be, can we please not waste food, or at least come up with, you know, and or at least come up with mechanisms to help us do it more efficiently and not waste it, to use it more efficiently. And that means kind of training people on, you know, how to cook better, how to cook more efficiently, and how to generate less waste when they do it. I think all those things are such important conversations to be had. And then on top of that, how do we use genetic engineering and other modern techniques to make food that lasts longer? Because now you're not going to waste that food if it still is good, well, you know, a week or two on the shelf. So how do we change the attitude of people? How do we change the acceptance of technology? And those two things really seem to be where I would focus if I was talking about food waste.
Yeah, really good stuff. It's very important. And I think what you're emphasizing is that a lot of the issues that we're concerned about, they're all interconnected in various ways. So you can't really partition one and say, I'm just going to focus on this one and then ignore everything else. Because I think a lot of the environmental groups do this. You know, they do that with nuclear power, where all they're going to talk about is why it's bad, or genetic engineering, or whatever it is, pesticides. You know, they just pick something, and then I think what our job is to say, hey, back up and look at the forest, and then I think we'll have a better chance at solving the problem. But, you know, our last story is actually sort of related, Kevin, in that we're talking about obesity here. So what are we talking about here?
Yeah, and this is pretty cool too, because this was a drug that was really designed for type 2 diabetes, and it was an experimental type 2 diabetes drug. That comes from a class of drugs called incretins. And incretins are hormones, they're gut peptides. They're secreted after you eat. And the idea is to stimulate insulin to be secreted. And really important, their main thing is to stimulate that insulin. And in the world of insulin resistance, in obesity, in Cretans are not doing exactly what they're supposed to do. So they've been really eyeballed as potential therapeutic targets to potentially help with obesity and with management of type 2 diabetes. And what they found in this last one, this is from an article called Tirzepatide, a drug that can help you shed 50 pounds or more is effective as bariatric surgery in trials. And this was on Gizmodo by Ed Cara. And we've talked about some of Ed's work before. And this is a drug that from Eli Lilly that is gone through phase 3 now. And they showed a very convincing dose response effect with management of blood sugar, but also a simultaneous decrease in weight. So when you compared a small dose, a 5 milligram dose of tirzepatide, people lost 15% of their body weight, which is pretty cool, over the course of 72 weeks, so like a year and a half or something. And then a 10 milligram dose lost 20%. And then a 15 milligram dose lost a little more. So the basic idea was that as you gave more of the drug, you saw more weight loss. And that idea of a dose response relationship is really important when we talk about the effects of drugs. And it should be noted that the placebo group also lost weight. So when you know you're in a fat loss study, or at least a treatment study where you may lose weight, you still may lose weight. So that's pretty good. It also has to be noted that there are side effects. So people reported diarrhea and vomiting and all kinds of other unpleasantries that were associated, again, in a dose response manner. But the major point is that this drug seems to have this effect of helping people lose weight. And these are associated again with this idea of a peptide secreted during digestion, which sends a signal to the body to control hunger.
Okay, so my first question is this going to be like a treatment that people take for their lives or for an extended period of time, something like an antidepressant or birth control, where to reap the benefit of it, you need to take it consistently. Whatever the interval of the dose is, you know, weekly or monthly or whatever it is it going to work that way? And the reason I ask is because I'm wondering, if you take this drug and you lose 50 pounds or whatever, does it sort of reset your metabolism in that sense? Like you restore your insulin sensitivity, you get your blood glucose under control, and then you can function normally. Or are you going to like fall back on your poor eating habits and start to enter the same cycle again? You know what I'm asking?
No, totally. And that was the same question I had. You know, not only is it a question of, you know, if you do this without lifestyle modification and relearning how to eat, is this thing your worst enemy? You know, can you take this, and there's also this question of access and equity too, with respect to the cost of the drug. But to your point is, would people who are on this drug, who are potentially losing weight because of the drug, say, well, that means I can have more pizza? You know, I mean, is this really its own worst enemy if your goal is to have someone lose weight? And it really just underscores the concept that weight management, and is something you know and we talked about many times, is really a question of a lifestyle change, potentially with some other things to go along with it, maybe bariatric surgery, maybe, you know, drugs that can help modify metabolism, at least for a little while. Bariatric surgery is kind of a one-way street, but that has to go with an entire relearning of how to control appetite and how to control eating desire. So it really is an interesting question as to how something like this drug, which they call Rigovi, which is another great way to name NFL linebackers, is you can take the drug, a drug name, and a city in Wisconsin and come up with an NFL player name.
Dude, that's so good. That's like what was your first dog's name and the first street you lived on or something? It's like one of those kind of things I see on social media all the time.
Oh yeah, no, the same thing. If you look at just the names in this article, I'll like give you a couple. And then I have a list of Wisconsin town names I can pull up here. Hang on. So like we go V Beloit, a wide receiver, Ozempic Appleton.
That sounds like some guy from Poland or something. Like, he's got like three Z's and an X and a CH for no reason in his name.
This last one's good. Rebelsis Nakusa. Strong safety from Baylor. Rebelsis Nakusa really did great at the trials this year. 4.200. You know, he's good.
That's so whatever. Good, man. It's like when we were talking about the COVID drugs and we were talking about how they sound like small Eastern European countries. That's
right.
So funny, man. Okay. To be serious for a second, and I think you're making a good point because, and this is anecdotal, I understand that, but I know a couple people who have had bariatric surgery and they lost tremendous amounts of weight, but I noticed in both of them, they didn't develop healthy habits. So one of them is very skinny today. But they don't eat a balanced diet. They'll go, they'll many hours at a time without eating, and then they'll eat a Twinkie, and then they'll go, you know. So like, that's one concern I have is like, when you go on a reasonable diet, and you have some input from a dietitian or from a physician, someone who can kind of counsel you through the process. Your eating habits change and you learn as you see results, you start to learn how to manage what you eat a little bit better. So, you know, like when you start weighing your food, for example, it's a pain in the ass initially, but then once you start doing it, you go, oh, now I sort of have a sense of like what a handful of almonds should look like. And, you know, do I really need a giant candy bar or am I just doing this out of habit? You know, you start to develop these sorts of habits. And then your metabolism starts to recover, right? So like there's these physiological changes that occur, and those can be long-term. You know, it takes some practice, but I don't know, I could be wrong, but I don't know if a drug or a surgery has that same sort of impact because it just nips the problem in the bud so quickly, you don't really have a chance to develop those.
Yeah, it has to be one leg on a stool of a multifaceted approach to weight loss and management that has to be smart and it has to go with a change in lifestyle. And from folks I know who've had bariatric surgery, it has forced a change in lifestyle. So it wasn't that, you know, the things, what had happened was, well, I can't eat that because I'll get sick. And that's, you know, I can't have that because, you know, after the surgery, I can't have that. Because the surgery basically was like putting a selective filter over their mouth that now they can't consume the stuff that they used to, not because they want to eat healthy, but because it'll make them sick. So it's like a negative reinforcement for their one-time habits. And, you know, and they look great. They feel much better. They've lost a lot of weight. Can't argue with the end point, but it's just a funny way to force a needed change.
100%. And I'm not in any way minimizing that obesity is a serious issue. And that for a lot of people, a treatment like this is probably very important. You know, like if you're at severe risk of developing some other condition that's related to metabolic syndrome or something, then by all means, this is probably an intervention that would be useful for people in that situation. You know, like if you need to lose a lot of weight quickly, then something like this, it probably makes sense. I'm just saying the way human nature is, right? We want the easiest way forward. We want the shortcut. We want the life hack, whatever it is. And that doesn't fix the problems long-term, I think.
Yeah, well, the other interesting part about this particular article that ties us in with the first article is that this stuff is super expensive. And that for some people who can get a benefit from it, it is possible to afford it because insurance doesn't necessarily cover it. And, you know, if this becomes approved for weight loss, okay, exclusively for weight loss. So that may happen. The thing that's interesting about this is just as the opioid antagonist drugs are so expensive, yet if we covered the cost for everybody who is addicted, the problem would be a lot less. Same thing here. If you could afford to get everybody on this thing who's overweight, would you ultimately have a very positive impact on the nation's health. And when you look at heart disease, stroke, diabetes, other, you know, related weight related disorders, you know, we're swimming in these things. We're like 33% people are obese. So would this be something that by having a federal intervention to make this available and ensure that this is something that, you know, we talk about COVID, how many people were infected, how many people died. I think this is of similar magnitude, that if you could have some sort of government, you know, moonshot type program to get everybody healthy and maybe finance a little drug, you know, maybe this plus some lifestyle choices and lifestyle changes could be really positive for us and save money in the long run. So just another bit of food for thought.
Yeah, it's a good point. And we'll talk about this another time, like, and you alluded to it earlier, but reducing the regulatory hurdles and the cost of getting a drug to market is a very, very important thing. And a lot of people start with the assumption that, you know, we need the FDA to very carefully look at this for a decade at a time before they approve something, because we want to keep people safe. But then the trade-off is, you know, a lot of people may die from a disease that we have a drug for, because the FDA is going over every single detail, maybe to the point that it doesn't make sense. And then, of course, there's tremendous cost involved in this. And we talk about this with genetically engineered crops and pesticides all the time. It takes forever to get these approved. And then that drives up the costs downstream. You know, so if it was cheaper to get these drugs onto the market, it wouldn't be as expensive to sell them, or as you know, you wouldn't have to charge as high a price to recoup all the investment to get the drug approved. And then in turn, insurance companies would probably be more likely to cover it, or be maybe a little more liberal with who they would cover it for, because the cost overall is down all the way down the line. So we can get into that in another episode, but that's just something to consider too, you know, in terms of equity and access to drugs, that would make a tremendous difference. All right, Kevin, who are you following on Twitter?
So lately I've been following, and he's been on fire, is Dr. Jonathan Stea, S-T-E-A. He's a clinical psychologist, but also serves as an adjunct professor at the University of Calgary. And he writes a lot for like Psychology Today, Scientific American, a number of publicly accessible publications, but does a really nice job on Twitter of sharing interesting tidbits about psychology, particularly in the area of misinformation, which I'm just enthralled with lately. So, you know, give him a follow. And his thing is, his username is at John A. Than Stea, S-T-E-A. So J-O-N-A-T-H-A-N, not Jonathan, Jonathan Stea. And there you go. So who are you following, Mr. Cameron?
I'm following Dr. Xavier Simons. He's a bioethicist. He is at the Plunkett Center for Ethics. And I forget which university that's at. But he's excellent. He talks about all these different bioethical issues. So recently he was tweeting about how do people fare when their father is an anonymous sperm donor? Like, what impact does that have on your life down the line? It's a really interesting question that you wouldn't really think about in most cases. And he just published a book on conscientious objection in healthcare, which is another controversial issue, but it's important to talk about. And I remember when the talk of COVID vaccine mandates first came down, Xavier was very helpful in helping me kind of think about the issue and think about the considerations that are involved. And he published a paper in, I think it was the British Medical Journal, sort of outlining the issue and making a reasonable argument for why a mandate might not be a good idea at a time when a lot of people were saying, Bill Gates is putting a microchip in the vaccine and he's taking over the world. And he was saying, well, hold on, let's make a more reasonable case for what we're trying to say. Anyways, so he is at Xavier Simons, and it's X-A-V-I-E-R-S-Y-M-O-N-S. At Xavier Simons. And we're going to leave it there. You guys can follow us as well at Kevin Falta on Twitter, at ACSH.org on Twitter. And my website is CameronJEnglish.net, where I post everything that I do. Thank you guys so much. We'll see you next time.